This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 3rd, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 245. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. Call it the 2022 Halftime Show. A special edition with Research Co's Mario Canseco and Simon Fraser University City Program Director Andy Yan. Find out how their 2022 predictions are faring so far and what's coming in the second half of the year. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It's halftime in 2022, and how have we done so far on the fearless predictions? I welcome back the crystal ball gazers from the first edition of the Breaker.News podcast of 2022, pollster Mario Canseco, president of Research Co., and Andy Yan, the director of the Simon Fraser University City Program. You know, he's also known around town as the Duke of Data. News this week, the end of June, that the barge on the beach stranded on Sunset Beach since last November in that windstorm, it's going to be deconstructed over the next 3 or 4 months. It has already outlasted the mask mandate, as both of you expected it would. Both of you expected the barge would stay there and the mask mandate would eventually disappear. So which will go away first in 2022, the mask mandate or the barge on the beach? Let's start with you, Andy.
Oh, that's a real, that's, there's the answer, I hope. I hope that the mask mandate will go first.
I think the barge is here to stay because nobody's going to spend as much money as is required to remove it.
The pandemic isn't over until it's over, and the barge isn't gone until it's gone. So first civic politics question in this election year: will the barge be gone before the October 15th civic election, or will the mask mandate return before the October 15th civic election? First, Mario Canseco.
I don't think the barge will be completely gone before the election happens. We know that the estimates that everybody in construction or any sort of field gives you, you need to double it. So if they say it's going to take 4 weeks, it's going to take 8. If they later say it's going to take 4 months, then it's going to take 8 months. So based on previous experience, I don't think this is going to be gone, and it might actually be a nice backdrop as we're preparing for the municipal race.
Andy.
I think it will. I agree with you, Mario, that it will still be there. I think that they're going to have issues in terms of labor, and I think in terms of equipment, there's probably only so many types of boats and as well as workers who know how to deconstruct a barge and how those folks are available, whether they'll be stuck at each other's respective airports, I think is going to be, I think, a challenge. I mean, we know that really what's going on is that what's unexpected, I think, are the levels of kind of labor challenges that I think are happening. And I think that they will have this kind of cascading effects. And I think that that will, I think, greatly add on to the deconstruction of the barge. But I also think that it's also mixed into the issues of the fact that you actually have some of the most, I think, densely populated parts of North America that's going to be within hearing distance. And I hear that taking apart a barge isn't particularly something you do in silence. And the kind of modifications towards work schedules and times, I think similarly will prolong the time for the for the removal of the barge. Mask mandates, I think that's going to be interesting. I think that they'll probably try to avoid a mask mandate, but then I think it will all depend upon, is there going to be a kind of fall surge, a kind of, if you will, it's kind of like a zombie movie with 5 minutes left, that there's a final jump scare that it comes out of the pandemic. And I think that in one way, I think they will probably be avoided as much as possible, but if push comes to shove, the mask mandates may return.
Now, next topic, of course, October 15th, civic elections across British Columbia. Do you think people in British Columbia are going to catch election fever? Do you think that Mayor Kennedy Stewart in Vancouver will win another term? I asked this before as well. Do you think that Surrey Mayor Doug McCallum will win another term in office and or a term in jail? He is, of course, charged with public mischief and has a court date October 31st, a couple weeks after the election. So what do you think? Mayor Kennedy Stewart, another term in office. Surrey Mayor Doug McCallum, another term, and maybe even a term in jail. Start with you, Andy Yan.
Well, I think, well, first of all, I think it's to acknowledge Mario's poll. I thought Mario doing a poll a couple of months ago, looking at really who the, I think, front runners are in the Vancouver election was incredibly insightful. And the insight I had wasn't necessarily about, say, what Kennedy Stewart leading the pack, which he did, or Ken Sims being number two, which he was, but then really the role of Colleen Hardwick. And actually, I think for me, it was the realization that a surprise was actually how well Colleen Hardwick had been doing in the face of, I think, a lot of doubters. And I think that gives you a sense that maybe the competition for mayor of Vancouver could very well be a race. But I think that that all being said, I think that whomever will be mayor of Vancouver is going to be facing a very similar, again, I've been trying to figure about to describe it as an Italian parliament or a Taiwanese parliament, or maybe it's a U.S. Congress in terms of the kind of rather chaotic, fractious nature of who would most likely be in council. Because, of course, the mayor is only one vote out of 11. And I think with the kind of mixture that we're seeing in the Vancouver civic election, I think that there doesn't seem to be a very clear majority in that, which is going to bring a certain level of uncertainty. Now, I think over in Surrey, I think it's really, I think how much Surrey is changing. And I mean, we'll see what happens with Doug McCallum. But then it's really, I think, the other candidates that I think begin to reflect and we've talked about this before, a sizably changing municipality within Surrey, and really how it's now, I think, not only people moving in, but then how they activate themselves in a new political culture. So I think that, you know, these are going to be interesting times for the two biggest cities in metropolitan Vancouver. And I think that it's going to be, I think, still a long time before the election. I mean, we're really just talking about like almost 3 months that a lot of things could happen.
Mario Canseco.
I'll start with Surrey. I don't think he's getting either of the terms. I don't think it'll be enough to justify him being behind bars. When we look at the Surrey election the last time, we had a dismal voter turnout. People were surprisingly happy with the way things were going. And we look at the massive majorities that Diane Watts used to command, the fact that we had more than half of voters supporting Linda Hebner in the election that she won. But that is a fairly small voter turnout, which is usually what happens when people aren't challenging the status quo. After everything that has happened with Doug McCallum, the sessions, the problems, the supposed running over of the foot, the romance, the difficulties, and the thousands of people who are moving into that city and want to do something about it, we can assume that the voter turnout is going to be higher and that people are going to be very engaged with the other candidates who are running. So I do think that there's a possibility, not only that McCallum loses, but also that he doesn't even contest the election. Right. And in Vancouver, whoever we have in first place in our final poll, that's who I want as mayor.
So, just real quickly on Surrey, does anyone think that there's a possibility Diane Watts could come out of nowhere, out of her retirement? She's now a business, a corporate board member. Do you think she might come out of retirement, throw her hat in the ring again, and assume the throne of being a mayor of Surrey again to get Doug McCallum out of office for the second time in her career? Or do you think she's just comfortable enough doing what she's doing as a corporate director?
I think part of it is you know, she did a lot as mayor. I mean, like I had the distinct pleasure of working with her through Bingtom Architects as a planner, and the sizable kind of civic investments that she facilitated. And I think that that kind of put Surrey on a particular urban track. And I think that certainly, I think over the in between those times, I think she's I think assumed a certain I think position through which I don't know if going back to being mayor of Surrey would be as rewarding, or she'd be able to do as much, because it's not as much as just being mayor, but it's the team that you have and that team on council that you have with you that you can make things happen. And that without a cohesive team, or at least a team of rivals, if you will, in council, I think that it's really difficult for anybody to be a mayor these days, just given I think the kind of challenges that the various cities are facing in Metropolitan Vancouver.
Yeah. If I were to put it in Lucien Bouchard's terms, you need winning conditions. Yeah. And that means having what she enjoyed when she was mayor, which is super duper majorities. Like everything we want to do, we'll do. Yeah. If there's that guarantee, I think she will do it.
Yeah, but I think without that, I think that it's really difficult. You'll have to kind of, you know, in one way, feed each other's kind of political aspirations and ambitions, through which is a lot of work, which means that there are some things you may not, probably actually a lot of things you won't be able to do, that especially with what she has in terms of experience and memories of what she was able to do in the good old days, that really isn't necessarily, I think, something that makes it very attractive. Now, Premier of British Columbia, on the other hand, that's the interesting question.
Now, the question about that, of course, was partially answered. She didn't run again for the BC Liberal leadership. Kevin Falcon did, and she was co-chair of his campaign. And when we looked at the 2022 crystal ball at the start of the year, we thought there'd be a little more competition for the BC Liberals. It didn't turn out to be that way. Kevin Falcon dominated. There were also a lot of allegations of cheating by his campaign in its membership sales, how it sold those memberships. And then, of course, after it was all over, he was late in submitting his returns to Elections BC. And when he did, we found out that he overspent by $500,000. Mm-hmm. And the BC Liberal Party kind of turned a blind eye to it. Headquarters said, no, he didn't break the rules, but it also didn't show us the complete breakdown. It wasn't very transparent. However, the story still is on the other side of the aisle. The people that do have the power, that's the NDP. They got the power until October 2024. Uh-huh. In January, I asked the question, neither of you predicted that John Horgan would announce his retirement in 2022. Will John Horgan announce his retirement in 2022?
I don't think it'll happen.
Andy?
Don't think it's going to happen, but the issue is actually how this might actually set up an environment where the NDP grasps defeat from the jaws of victory.
That just happened in the last week of June. John Horgan will be retiring from the premiership by the time that the NDP has a leadership campaign sometime this fall. He hasn't said when he'll actually leave politics. He'll probably stick around as an MLA after that. He can bank some time for his pension. But first order of business is selecting a new leader for the NDP. Start with you, Mario Canseco. Who will be John Horgan's successor? Name one and explain why.
If we have to narrow it down only to one, I think the best chance would be for David Eby. There's a couple of reasons why I'm leaning towards that side. One of them is that he's had very interesting cabinet positions. Yep. There was a moment when he was sort of dropping and not maybe be such a big story. BC Liberals hate him with a passion, and I think that would be important for the NDP to put somebody there who is going to drive the opposition nuts. I think we saw it with all of the campaign related to the so-called EV tax that resulted in a bunch of billboards that were very poorly written that appeared around the west side of Vancouver.
Yeah.
And, you know, he is right now celebrating a victory, getting $150 million from Purdue Pharma. Is significant. Sure, it's not the $1 billion that the government expected, but if we need $400 million to host the World Cup, we're almost a third of the way there. So that's not bad.
Right. Yeah. I I'm liable to agree with Mariel that I think that it's David Eby's to lose. I think that, you know, while you may have other candidates like Nathan Cullen, I think that some folks have talked about Bawen Ma, that I think that it's really looking at what David Eby has done in terms of probably two of the toughest portfolios in provincial government, whether that be the Attorney General's portfolio as well as the housing portfolio, that I think really I think has I think he's made an impact, and he's shown up a level of results. Now, I think what's interesting is really how he's going to work, not only within, say, the city of Vancouver or just Vancouver in general, but it's really going to be his appeal to the rest of the province. I think that while John Horgan was very much, say, a premier that you're happy to have a beer with, that, you know, or maybe it's a kale smoothie in the city of Vancouver, that really I think that there was a projection of a certain character, certain, I think, friendliness that I think, and it's interesting to kind of say an example of, say, the comparison between someone like John Horgan and Christy Clark. That they were both personalities through which wasn't just about appealing to these kind of deep urban cores, whether they be in Victoria or in Vancouver, but across the province, and having a certain comfort level just towards that type of approachability that John Horgan and Christy Clark offered. That I think what's interesting is seeing if David can, if you will, convert all those skills in towards and an appeal towards, say, suburban metropolitan Vancouver, the Okanagan, a lot of the kind of, I think, bases that the NDP were able to get from the Liberals, and whether they're able to kind of maintain the pace, maintain the kind of majority they were able to get with the last election, simply because I think it's in one way a lot about the personalities of the leaders and their interface with really the diverse faces in the province of British Columbia.
Now, look back at another question I asked you back in January about the Vancouver 2030 Olympics bid, which had been announced formally by the mayors of Vancouver and Whistler and leaders of the four host First Nations back in December 2021. Since then, we've got a little bit of information, a few morsels. They tell us that the cost estimates will be coming sometime in mid-July, but they have told us some of their ideas for venues, mostly 2010 venues reused, but they also want to have freestyle skiing and snowboarding up at Sun Peaks near Kamloops instead of Cypress. They want to use the PNE heavily. They want to put curling at the Agrodome. They want to have medal ceremonies and concerts at the amphitheater. They want to have a big air jump at Hastings Race Course, and of course, put short track speed skating and figure skating at the Coliseum again. So they've talked a bit about that. This proposal for the 2030 Winter Olympics in Vancouver hasn't really been the talk of the town, but it's something which could definitely affect the town if under the new IOC method of awarding the games, if it does come back somehow. So there are still questions about that, and questions about the cost, of course, still questions about cost of 2010, which we don't have answers to. Now, Vancouver is in the running so far with Sapporo, Japan, the 1972 host, Salt Lake City, the 2002 host. The question is this: the IOC wants to know really who's in and who's out by December of this year. The Canadian Olympic Committee doesn't want anybody to have a referendum, but the IOC basically wants to know who's in, who's out by December so they can start negotiations so they can ultimately get a decision by the end of May 2023. The question is this, not about whether Vancouver will be at the finish line, crossing the finish line next year, but will the councils in Vancouver and Whistler and the First Nations, will they go ahead beyond July? Will Vancouver be part of the mix in December to take the next round towards this? Because right now, the provincial government hasn't given any funding approval. The Canadian Olympic Committee is going to be talking to the federal government as well in the fall. Does this bid have any life in it? Is there a chance Vancouver can be part of the mix when the IOC starts talking to the bidders in December? Mario.
Well, I'd say that there's a little bit more life in the bid now that you have the involvement of the First Nations. We know that young people have reacted very positively to this, and they believe that it's a good idea. That is also tapered down by the skepticism of the over 55 crowd, who isn't particularly thrilled with what is happening. But I think one of the complexities that we're going to be facing is What happens when it comes to the provincial investment? We saw a lot of time spent on what I like to call the John Horgan Premier Library, the museum that was abandoned. It seemed to be something very important to him. And at the end of the week, he essentially said, this isn't going to make sense. And he was already planning his retirement. So it was abandoned, but there's no real commitment here. I think one of the reasons why the bid support for the bid dropped so drastically last year is you still had the same people from the last time talking about it. You had John Furlong saying this is going to be free, supported by very poorly conducted opinion research that sort of suggested that the Olympics were going to cure every ailment if we did them again. It wasn't the best course of action. And now I think people are warming up to the idea that this isn't going to be the John Furlong show. There's also that indigenous involvement that is attractive. And we're back into a level of support, which is a little bit better than where it used to be. Now, it's not overwhelming. It's not as if everybody wants to see this happen. But I think ultimately it will depend on how much other governments, not just Vancouver and Whistler, can get behind this.
I think some really, I mean, will Vancouver even show up to the race in for the Olympics? But I think that I again, we agree a lot, Mario. I think that this is it's one of the things that I think the detail, if you will, on this will be, if you will, the in-between kind of discussions around, you know, with what happens with FIFA, and then as well as, frankly, the Vancouver Art Gallery. And I think, Hal, speaking of things that have found additional life, the Vancouver Art Gallery has seemed to have found its own little kind of re-spark. And I think that this kind of public appetite towards these sizable investments, I think, are going to be the thing to watch and to kind of see what will happen with those two. To kind of, I think will in one way, I think, guide really what will happen towards that bid. But that being said, you know, I wonder if within the race for the mayoralty as well as council for the city of Vancouver, whether the demand for a referendum or some kind of accountability for a Olympics, I think, will come into those races. And I think that that is, I think, certainly, I think the participation of the Indigenous nations, the respective Indigenous nations, I think, has added a certain dynamic, a certain richness, a certain, I think, element of support. But yet, I think, at the same time, I think that how the respective parties that are running for the mayor or council will fit in towards the kind of, I think, decision making that needs to, that would, I think, be needed, and that kind of consensus building towards hosting an Olympics or not, I think, is something yet to be seen. And I think that, you know, I'd be curious if someone would do a poll on the, having this. I don't know who. Mariel, perhaps you might have some suggestions towards a potential pollster to look at this question, because I think you're right. It's like, what is the public appetite in the face of the, you know, the former premier library that was similarly suspended. I think similarly is a kind of concern in terms of large public expenditures, whether they be for large facilities or public events.
And finally, we get to our lightning round. Just want some yes or no answers here. We'll touch upon within this lightning round some of the big international news of this year. The biggest international news this year, of course, Russia's legal invasion of Ukraine. Here's a big question. Will Vladimir Putin be in office by the end of this year, or will Vladimir Putin be 6 feet under by the end of this year? Will he be alive, or will he stay in office in the Kremlin? Andy Yan.
First thing, Slava Ukraini. I think that that's the first thing I'll say. I think that it's going to be, I think, an interesting question because, you know, does this mean we learn how to remove thermonuclear dust off of our windows? That I think that, you know, the kind of slight existential problems all this perhaps does bring in for our world. I think that it's interesting. I think that part of this is giving them a chance to withdraw with a level of face. I think that so far things have been done rather intelligently in terms of not having NATO step into this, but yet at the same time, I think supporting the Ukrainians. I think that will he still be? I think he'll still be around, whether he'll be in power or whether he'll be in kept in check. I'd say yes, he'll be in power, probably, but it'll be in a reduced role.
Mario Canseco, Vladimir Putin, will he be in the Kremlin or in a coffin?
I don't think he'll be in either of those. I think there'll be a moment when he decides to step aside for whatever reason, and then somebody else is the one who has to sign the armistice. So neither, but certainly not where he is right now.
All right, and now we got three questions left. Just give me a yes or a no. The lightning round. First, inflation. Will inflation hit 10% during the rest of 2022? Andy Yan, yes or no, inflation 10%?
No.
Mario Canseco?
No, I don't think it will.
Gas prices. That's also been another big story this year related to the war in Ukraine. Gas prices. Will gas prices in British Columbia, among the most expensive North America, will gas prices here hit $3 a liter? Mario Canseco, yes or no?
Only in the areas where you pay the TransLink tax. Yes.
Yes, but you got to ask about interest rates.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay. What do you think about interest rates? Where will they go? Will they go into double digits? Andy.
Well, that's going to be directly affiliated towards that 10% inflation rate. I think that the Bank of Canada plus the U.S. Feds will do whatever it takes now to really arrest that inflation rate. I think that double digit interest rates, if necessary, but not necessarily double digit interest rates. I think that it will definitely have an increase in interest rates. I think that it will ease. I think right now they're going at about what, 5-6% right now. I think it doesn't mean the point, if memory serves me right. I didn't see the news this morning, but that I think it's easily going to be the 8 or 9%, especially if inflation keeps on going. But I don't think it's going to hit double digits. If it does, I think that there are going to be severe knock-on effects. And I'm not only talking about housing. I think it's also about commercial loans that I think similarly will pose a number of kind of sizable challenges. But I think that being said, I think that with what's happening with inflation, I think that they are willing. I mean, interest rates are definitely going to go up.
Mario Canseco, just yes or no? We're running out of time here. Interest rates, will they hit double digits? Yes or no?
Very near double digits, but I don't think they will. It's such a complicated situation. Yeah. Suddenly, 9.9 is exceedingly lower compared to 10. So they're going to do their best not to bring it to double digits because they know it's a psychological barrier that no government wants to deal with.
Yeah.
And finally, we'll wrap up the halftime look at 2022. We're looking at looking back at the predictions made, but looking forward to predictions for the rest of 2022. The Canadian Football League season is on. Will the BC Lions end the season as Grey Cup champions? Yes or no? Andy Yan?
I just have to say yes, and I don't have any reason except that I live in BC.
Mario Canseco?
I am going to say yes. I think this is a team that has managed to rekindle with the base in a way that was totally unexpected a couple of years ago. So hopefully they go all the way.
Excellent. Well, that's Mario Canseco, president of Research Co. And we also have Andy Yan, who is the director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University, the Duke of Data. Thanks for joining us again at this half-year, half-time special for 2022. We've looked back at some of the predictions made at the start of this year. We've got new predictions for the rest of this year. We look forward to having both of you back to look at predictions, look at what has happened in 2022 when we get to the end of this crazy year. So thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast, on the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, NATO chief accuses China of bullying Taiwan. Jens Stoltenberg warns against Beijing's growing nuclear arsenal. According to Stoltenberg, China was not an enemy of the organization, but the serious threats it poses needed to be understood. Beijing's expansion threatens the interests, security, and values of NATO members, the updated document said. Another sign of NATO's growing interest in Asia was its invitation to the leaders of the Indo-Pacific nations, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea, to attend the Madrid summit. In Kyoto news, three Chinese Navy ships circumnavigate Japan as Tokyo remains on alert. Three Chinese Navy ships have circumnavigated the Japanese archipelago over the past weeks as Tokyo stays on alert for increasing military activity by Beijing and Moscow in nearby waters, Japan's defense ministry said. Among the Chinese military's recent activities near Japan, fighter jets were seen taking off from and landing on the Chinese aircraft carrier Liaoning near the Okinawan Islands for 12 days last month. And in Hong Kong Free Press, G7 attempts to compete with China's Belt and Road Initiative with $600 billion U.S. infrastructure plan. The Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment aims to fill a huge gap left as Communist China uses its economic clout to stretch diplomatic tentacles into the furthest reaches of the world. Funding the kinds of projects that China currently dominates, everything from roads to harbors in far-flung corners of the world, is not aid or charity, said President Joe Biden. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, shame on them. Family members of 9/11 victims denounce LIV Golf Tournament at Pumpkin Ridge. The golf series, which boasts golf stars like Phil Mickelson and Bryson DeChambeau, has drawn scrutiny from U.S. Senator Ron Wyden and others because it's funded by the Middle Eastern country's Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is affiliated with the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the country's government. One by one, family members of 9/11 victims who traveled to Oregon from other states shared stories of their loved ones at the press conference and accused the Saudi regime of engaging in sports washing, a way for the country to improve its reputation in the West by hosting a popular sporting event. They wore red and blue hats that read 9/11 Justice. In King 5, Norwegian cruise ship returns to Seattle after hitting iceberg in Alaska. On June 25th, while transiting to Hubbard Glacier in Alaska, the ship Norwegian Sun made contact with an iceberg less than 6.6 feet across, with just a few feet that shows above the water. The decision was made to shorten the voyage. All guests on board disembarked in Seattle as originally planned, according to the cruise line. In Czech news, contractor cuts down an estimated 80 trees without permits in Nanaimo. The property is zoned industrial and the owner has plans to develop it, but it hadn't registered any plans with the city when a contractor started clearing the land. According to the city's bylaw, a tree is classified as being more than 6 centimeters in diameter. The city's bylaws set out fines ranging from $500 to $10,000 per tree, depending on the tree's significance and the egregiousness of the offenses. It could be delivered as a fine, a summary conviction through the courts, or a consent agreement. Last month, a contractor and a property management company were hit with more than $200,000 in fines after they allegedly damaged or cut down over 100 protected trees in Courtney. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people who support the Breaker.News on Patreon. People like Kevin, Darian, Amy, Claire, Chris, David, Brian, John, Chris, Lisa, Aird, John, Michael, Ian, Brian, Kelly, Leslie, Mondi, Laura, Elvio, Barbara, Richard, Lee, and John. Thank you to them on this half-year special. Why not join them? Keep listening to find out how you can support the Breaker.News podcast. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Tommy Brown. Ваша козацькорона.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 3rd, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 3rd of July in the year 1608, Samuel de Champlain established Quebec City? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.